All right, everyone, I'm going to call the meeting of the House Committee on Rules together for to order for Thursday, May 11th, 2017. So first order of business, we will be rolling over to Tuesday, House Bill 2813, House Bill 3241, and House Bill 3203. That, I will open a work session for the introduction of committee measures.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have LC 4477 in front of you. It's relating to work time limits. It is coming at the request of the chair of the committee for introduction today.
Yes. Question, Madam Chair. I haven't seen it, so could we have a summary of what this is?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, LC 4477 directs employer and specified industries to pay greater of daily or weekly overtime when employee is eligible for both in some in same work week. It declares the employer satisfies certain overtime laws by paying greater of the applicable daily or weekly overtime, prohibits employer from requiring certain employees to work 160 hours in one work week, creates private cause of action to enforce certain overtime laws, authorizes court to award cost disbursements and reasonable attorney fees to prevailing parties for violations of certain overtime laws.
Is that prevailing party or prevailing plaintiff? But one question I have is, I think there is a bill, isn't there, Madam Chair, about the overtime? It's quite contentious going on right now. So I'm curious, you know what, maybe this is not the appropriate time. I guess I'm gonna oppose just because I haven't had time to review the bill. So I won't be voting in favor of the committee bill. But once I read it, maybe I'll support it.
And Madam Chair, Representative Klein is prevailing party.
It's a prevailing party.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So with that, Madam Chair, I move LC 4477 to be introduced as a committee measure.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved LC 4477 be introduced as a committee measure. Is there any discussion, additional discussion? I will give the regular... A disclaimer that voting for an introduction of the measure does not mean that you will support the underlying bill. Are there any objections? Representative McLean. Representative Barreto. That motion passes. Thank you. I will close the work session on introduction of committee measures. I will open a work session on House Bill 2391. And colleagues, we are hearing this, or we're working this to move to Ways and Means without recommendation.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2391 did come to us from the House Healthcare Committee. It does have a fiscal impact to the Oregon Health Authority. We are going to move it to Ways and Means. The bill as requires Oregon Health Authority to submit basic health plan blueprint to Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services by December 31st, 2017. It currently does not have a subsequent referral, so we will be requesting the addition of one.
Oh, wait. Gotcha. Okay.
All right. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2391 without recommendation, and it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 2391 without recommendation, and it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? That motion passes. I will close the work session. I open a work session on House Bill 3331.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, similar situation with House Bill 3331. It does came to us from your Human Services Committee. It does have a subsequent impact to the Oregon Housing and Community Services Agency, and it needs to go down to Ways and Means as well. So we're requesting that it too be referred to Ways and Means without a recommendation as to passage.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3331 without recommendation, and it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 3331 without recommendation, and it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Representative Barreto.
Yeah,
okay. Any additional discussion? Objections? Representative Barreto. That motion passes. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3331. I will open a work session on House Bill 3253.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3253 clarifies that state agencies and departments shall purchase certain products and services from Commission for the Blind. It establishes the Business Enterprise Program within Commission to maintain and manage authorized vending facilities, requires Commission to facilitate certain dispute resolution meetings, requires Commission to submit annual report to Legislative Assembly, becomes operative January 1, 2018. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We did receive a dash 5 amendment. It did become available on OLIS shortly before the meeting. I believe we have the sponsor of the amendment here to discuss it. This did come to you from your Human Services Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kennegar from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I'm really pleased to bring you House Bill 3253, which is an attempt to really revise in many ways the Commission on the Blind's Blind Enterprise Program. This is a program that is intended to provide remunerative employment from blind Oregonians. It came out of the federal Randolph-Shepard Act that was established in 1936. We currently have 14 licensed managers that operate vending routes, cafeterias, and snack bars in state and federal facilities, and actually beyond the state as well, many other political subdivisions. There are many ways that we can improve this program. We've looked at programs across the country, and many programs, such as Tennessee, have about 100 blind vendors. We have had several issues in our program. Part of it is there's been some question as to whether blind vendors can subcontract with vending companies. So there's been kind of an ongoing legal battle. We've had opinions from the AG that has said we cannot do that. And then there have been other appeals processes that have argued that we can. And so really what we wanted to do, rather than have this be in kind of a legal limbo, was clear up whether or not subcontracting could be done, and if so, under what circumstances, and how at the same time can we really improve and make the best use of this program possible. So we've had many, many meetings over the last few weeks. I'm sorry that this is coming to you kind of late. It was one of the bills that was in my committee on Human Services and Housing. And as you may know, we only had 2 meetings a week, and we were flooded with well over 100 bills in that amount of time. And so this was one that I kind of put on the side because I thought was really important and wanted to delve into. So right after the April 18th deadline, we really delved into this. We moved it over to rules to give it a little more time. And since that time, Representative Hack has been really helpful in sitting down. But we've had many, many conversations with the blind managers, and you will hear from the chair of their elected body with the Commission on the Blind, who is in the room as well, and they will probably come up here as well, with vending companies and many, many people involved in this program. So I want to turn it over to Representative Hack to talk about what the bill does in front of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Jody Hack, representing House District 19. I would like to thank Representative Kennegar for all of her hard work on this important issue. As I quickly learned, there were many, many facets to this, and I think a lot of great work has been done. So I'll quickly kind of breeze through what the bill does. It establishes priority for the commission to operate vending machines, snack bars, micro markets, cafes, convenience stores, espresso and coffee carts, food trucks to counties, towns, cities, villages, local governments, and municipalities to put more blind people to work. It maintains preferences for operating cafeterias, clarifies the law to allow subcontracting with approval by the commission. The commission will provide a list of pre-approved subcontractors. It increases transparency. The commission will provide quarterly reports of assigned and unassigned vending to the Business Enterprise Consumer Committee and to the public. The commission's BEP must provide quarterly set-aside financial reports to the governor's workforce policy advisor and to the BECC, which is the Business Enterprise Consumer Committee. The commission's BEP must submit the annual performance report and any surveys done to the legislature annually. With active participation by managers of the BECC, commission will provide a statement describing full-time responsibilities. In the case of death or incapacitation of a licensed manager, a spouse or domestic partner may operate vending facilities for up to 6 months or the end of the contract for the purpose of winding down the operations. It requires the commission, with active participation of the BECC, to determine set-aside amounts and discounts for employing blind, disabled, and veteran employees for selling and or locally produced foods. I just want to say again that there's been a great deal of work done prior to my stepping in and helping Representative Kenny Guyer, and I commend the commission and those other folks, Randy and many others that came to the table to do some great work. There are a few bumps in this. I don't know that we're completely finished. You may hear from some folks that there may be a few more things to iron out on the Senate side. Representative Kenny Guyer and myself are committed to helping see that through as well, but we appreciate your time today and your willingness to move this out of committee.
Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you going to address the issue of amendments? I understood there were some dash five amendments.
So I can't remember what just went up on OLIS today at 105. That's the dash five. So what Representative Hack described is basically the dash five. It's a total gut and stuff. The original bill that came to us was from the licensed blind managers, and Randy can talk more about that, but they wanted to really grow the program in a way that many other states have, and that required changing the statutes to have it be a priority in a number of places. We didn't go after the cafeterias. We left that as is. Right now, everything is by preference only. DAS is the only state agency that wrote into their own administrative rules that they would give it a priority, but everywhere else is a preference. So we're moving that up to priority. But at the same time, what I really want to emphasize is that one of the ways that we, being members of this legislative body and a number of others, the governor's office and others, have really wanted to see this program move more toward an employment model and have people who are blind be out there in the community and really working it. And there was concern about just relying on subcontractors. And so this is really an attempt by everyone to say, what are the things that we really need to do to come to an agreement on what the program should be doing and how can we move it in that direction by giving clarity in statutes. So one of the pieces that Representative Hack mentioned at the end was having to do with the set-aside amount. There's currently a 11% set-aside, which means from the net profits they make from this program, they turn 11% of that back as a set-aside to a pot of money that's used for a number of purposes, and that is already set by rule. Randy can talk about it, but it's meant to support just the program. And we were looking at ways to incentivize hiring more people that were blind or had disabilities or were veterans, and also we're trying to incentivize having healthy food and locally produced food produced in Oregon as incentives. If any of you who are here in 2013 may remember that I had a bill that mandated healthy vending, and that did not go over very well, and that's how I first started working with the licensed blind managers. I didn't even realize that our vending machines, which are on, they have no rent. The state facilities, public sector facilities, give free rent, free utilities for this, and I was thinking, why are we having machines on free space like that? We're subsidizing it to some degree, and then we're paying the healthcare costs for PEB. So why, this should be healthy. And that's when I started learning about how the program is working. And so this takes a very different approach and tries to incentivize having healthier food and hiring people with disabilities, giving a higher incentive if you hire someone who's blind, because the program is primarily meant for people who are blind. But also, people who are blind cannot drive the trucks to fill the machines. And so there's a lot of opportunities for other people. If we are going to prioritize and subsidize the space, then we should really have it be a vigorous work employment program, and to the extent possible, having healthier foods or foods that are produced in Oregon.
And I'd just like to add that it's an opportunity for more younger entrepreneurs to come in and also have an opportunity to create a business, grow a business, and we've incentivized them in a way, too, that will have new opportunities for others to enter into the blind vending program and also incentivize them to then create and grow a business and hire people and not just have it be a one-person job opportunity, but create employment opportunities for others.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Hout, and I am a lifelong blind Oregon resident. I also have been a licensed blind vendor. We like to call us entrepreneurs. That's what this program does for over 30 years. And I currently serve as the elected committee chair of the Business Enterprise Consumer Committee, which is a federally mandated and state authorized committee that represents the licensed blind entrepreneurs that are licensed here in Oregon. And like Representative Kenny Geyer mentioned earlier, we're not only trying to bring integrity back to the program and find a way to constructively move forward and put more blind people to work. There's 70% unemployment for people who are blind. That's a high, high number. In Tennessee, which is a state that we've researched in depth, there's over 115 licensed blind vendors. In Tennessee, why we picked Tennessee is not too much different than Oregon as far as the population, and there's no big military installations. But what's different in Tennessee is they have, by statute, enforced the intent of the federal act and the state act. And it's clearly the intent of this program to put blind entrepreneurs to work. There shouldn't be 14 here in Oregon. There should be 50 or more. When we brought this proposed legislation forward, we said, how can we make this a winner-winner for everybody, not only putting blind people to work, entrepreneurs in their own businesses, and paying that money back to the state to help fund the program, but how can we make opportunities for more disabled people and more blind persons, and how can we bring integrity back to this? I can tell you out on OLIS, we have support from national organizations, we have support from local organizations, and we also have support from private enterprise. Those companies that we partner with. And I just really would hope and encourage that this proposed legislation, you know, be considered thoroughly and fully. And I also want to thank Representative Hack and Representative Kenny Geyer and their commitment to helping make this a reality and all the time and effort they've put into this. And, you know, it's not perfect, but I think we're 99.9% the way there. There's just a few more things that need to be tweaked. And, again, I respectfully request that your consideration and support of this bill. Thank you very much.
I just want to also thank Erica Hoover, my staff, who's here, who's doing hours and hours and hours of, talking with the federal counterparts and others. And I do want to, again, emphasize, we just got the amendment. We can also already see little teeny tweaks here. They're not substantive tweaks. I think that substantively and conceptually, I think it's pretty much where we want to be, although, of course, now that it's being aired, we want to hear from people. But we already know there's little words here and there that are going to need to be tweaked on the Senate side. We don't want to run out of time and leave this program in the kind of legal limbo it's been in. And so we really hope that you are able to I think it's a good bill, but I would say it's 85-90% there, and it just needs an opportunity for full vetting, and it needs an opportunity for tweaking words, and we're hoping to do that on the Senate side.
Thank you. Aaron Morris.
Apologize, I haven't been in this room before. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Morris. I'm with the Commission for the Blind. I'm the Business Enterprise Director. I run the program that Randy was talking about. I was going to wait for a question, but this isn't that kind of a presentation. The Dash 5 amendments, as was just testified to, just came out about an hour ago, and I would echo the comments that were made earlier. I've tried to get through it on my iPhone, and there's a lot of pages involved with that. I did want to speak to the priority, which was talked about earlier. Programs across the nation, business enterprise programs, they all look a little bit different. Tennessee, Texas, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, all of the state programs are just a little bit different on the state level. But one of the common factors is the larger programs, the big programs that have lots of managers, have the priority within the state, which gives the Commission for the Blind and the blind managers the opportunity to go out and run a variety of different types of food service operations. So that's one of the biggest common factors. Obviously, the rest of the bill, I haven't really dug into all of the details, and quite frankly, I'm still not an expert at reading Dash 4 and Dash 5 amendments. It's a skill set that I'm developing. But the priority for the state to make that change from preference to priority is probably the biggest thing that will ever happen to this program. So I would definitely be supportive of that.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are in work session. So we're going to move the dash five.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the dash five amendments to House Bill 3253.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the dash five amendments into House Bill 3253. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, in Representative Hack's testimony, it was she had mentioned disabled and veterans or disabled veterans. And in the dash five, I haven't seen that and wondered if that was intended to be in there or if I'm missing it or if it will be introduced over in the Senate.
Madam Chair, so that's part of the incentives on the set aside. So we had originally talked about that being included in rulemaking, but it is page 10. Starts on, let's see. You can look on section 12, page 10, and it'll start to outline all of those. That's part of the set-aside. So it's an incentive for them if they were to hire a blind person to work for them. They get a percentage off and so on for disabled and veterans. And they get more incentive for hiring as they go, more percentage off of the set-aside. Lines 25 to 30.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Any objections? Motion passes.
And Madam Chairman of the committee, we will hopefully have fiscal and revenue back for our next meeting, so we will stop here today with this measure.
All right. I will close the work session on House Bill 3253. Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2545A.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, 2545A was heard on the 9th, at which time we adopted the A9 amendment, which replaced the underlying measure and allows police, corrections, parole, or probation officers to use any instrument or mechanical device to detect deception or verify the truth of statements, except traditional polygraph machine, in course of investigating crime, conducting an investigation into misconduct in prison, or providing oversight over parolees and probationers. It adds ocular motor deception detection examination to definition of deception detection examination. It prohibits use of deception detection examination as condition of employment. We now have a minimal fiscal statement and a no revenue statement on the A9 amendments.
All right, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2545A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 2545A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Carriers, Representative Hack. I will close the work session on 2545A. We will open a work session on House Bill 2750A.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2750A permits Port of Hood River to establish toll on bridges. Port of Hood River has authority to operate and maintain, outline circumstances that the port is subject to state contracting processes, prevailing wage rates, land use laws, and public-private partnership. You have an A2 amendment permits Port of Hood River to sell or transfer ownership of any bridge or its approaches it owns as part of a tollway project. You also have an A4 amendment that I believe Representative Holvey has before you today as well. We have a fiscal statement and a revenue statement on the A2 amendments, Madam Chair.
Thanks.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. The A2 as drafted was an attempt to limit a concern about the sale provision. That's in subsection 2, and it limits it essentially to if you're going to be replacing the bridge in the bridge replacement ceremony. So it only allows the sale in that circumstance. We've committed, and I know there are additional issues. The Port of Hood River is committed working with Representative Holvey and Representative Rayfield on a couple other issues around protecting private or public access and the public rights in that regard, as well as making sure that there aren't inadvertent and effects on the public contracting elements of this. And we really appreciate the spirit in which they've worked with us and look forward to continuing to do that work in the Senate.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bates? All right.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dan, who's your client?
My client is the Port of Hood River.
Okay. And is the, thank you. May I follow up? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Is the Port of Hood River in favor of the dash A2 or the dash 4?
The Port of Hood River, Representative McLean, Chair Williamson, is in support of the A2.
A2. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, you have a question? Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A2 amendment to. Oh. All right, Madam Chair, I move the dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2750A.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2750A. Is there discussion? Representative Polvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate Mr. Bates commenting on some of the challenges in this. I do want to see this bill go forward. I want to see this project come to fruition. I do have concerns with the A2, as he may have described. In the bill, they do exempt the entire public contracting code under the tolling statutes. I believe our, I think that's three under ORS 381. And though they do leave the prevailing wage in there, which is comforting, it appears that the bill impacts all tolling projects in the state, not just the Hood River. So I have a great deal of concern about that. And there's a lot of different pieces of this bill that I think still need to be worked on. I hope to be able to keep engaging in that conversation with them on the Senate side as it moves over there. We largely want to make sure that the state's interest as well or investment is also recognized in this process, and that the public access is protected if the bridge is ever sold, which I believe the bill allows. And so that's a little bit of a concern as well. So in working with ODOT, I sort of came up with the A4, and it maybe is a little onerous in having OTC approval that Hood River may not be. I haven't actually talked to him about the A4 specifically, but I it may be a little too onerous for them, I'm guessing. But anyway, we'll be a no on this, but want the bill to pass. I just want to flag that I want to continue to work on parts of this bill.
Thank you. Additional discussion, Representative Rayfield.
And just very quickly, again, I would also comment a big thank you to Dan Bates, also Representative Johnson, for working on this. The project should go forward. It's very important, but I also, for the same reasons with Representative Holdme, will be a no on both of them.
Additional discussion. All right. Yeah. Sam, can you call the roll on the amendment?
Representative Brito?
Aye.
Representative Pat?
Aye.
Representative Holdme?
No.
Representative Fetimer?
Aye.
Aye.
President Smith Warren?
No.
Vice Chair McLean?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
No.
Chair Williamson?
Aye. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2570A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 2750 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Sam, can you call the roll? Thank you.
Aye.
Representative Pat?
Aye.
Representative Colby?
No.
Representative Fetimer?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner?
No.
Vice Chair McLean?
Aye.
Chair Rayfield?
No.
Chair Williamson?
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Johnson will be the carrier. I will close the work session on House Bill 2750A. I don't know that we're ready to do that. We are going to take a recess until 3 so paperwork can catch up with us. Thank you, Vice Chairman. We are back from recess. Welcome back, everyone. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3440.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3440 comes to you from your House Healthcare Committee. It specifies the Oregon Health Authority may use prescription monitoring information to determine whether practitioners are prescribing opioids or opiates in compliance with guidelines for prescribing the drugs. You do have a -3 amendment. I will call your attention to the -3 amendment because it replaces the underlying measure and permits pharmacists, pharmacy, healthcare professional, or any person designated by State Board of Pharmacy to administer naloxone, thank you, and distribute necessary medical supplies to administer naloxone provides good faith immunity to individual who does administer the drug. In accordance with Board of Pharmacy rules, pharmacists may prescribe naloxone and necessary supplies to administer the drug, permits employee or social service agency to administer naloxone that was not distributed to them to individual who appears to be experiencing opiate overdose. For reimbursement purposes, insurer of health plan benefit health benefit plan may not require prior authorization. Payment of initial 30-day supply of naloxone prohibits denial into specialty court if individual is taking, intends to take, prescribed medication for drug abuse or dependency treatment. Oregon Health Authority will develop and update online searchable inventory and which will include the following information. Each opioid and opiate abuse or dependency treatment provider in Oregon, treatment options offered by providers, maximum capacity of each provider. OHA is to report to interim committees related to health care not later than September 15th of each year on an analysis of geographic data of treatment options to determine if there are insufficient treatment options in Oregon. OHA is to report no later than September 15th of each year to related health care committee, governor, and each local health department every 3 months on total number of opioid and opiate overdoses and related deaths. The measure takes effect 91st day after signing die. This measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have not received the full paperwork on the -3 amendment.
Excellent. Judge Block, Aaron Brown, and Paul Lewis, come on up. Welcome.
And Chair Williamson, and Vice Chairs McLean and Rayfield, thank you for having us here today. Aaron read through that really quickly. Would you like me to review it by section and rationale, or what would you like me to do? I think that would be great. Okay, that's great. So my name is Paul Lewis. I'm a practicing pediatrician. I also serve as the Multnomah County and Portland Metro Area Tri-County health officer, and I inherited from my predecessor, Gary Oxman, who'd been the long-term health officer, ongoing work to address opioid misuse. It's a really pervasive problem for us, and I recently learned it's actually, by the numbers, actually worse in rural Oregon. Both the rate of overdose and the rate of opioid addiction, you know, per population is actually higher in rural Oregon than in the metro area. So it really does affect the entire state. And the solutions to this problem are actually quite complex. It's a this kind of drug addiction is a chronic disease. It doesn't have a simple cure. There's consequences to individuals' health, including death from overdose, physical dependence. There's consequences to their immediate family, to their work life, and to the entire community, including the justice community. So it is a very, very pervasive problem for which the solutions are complicated. The components of this bill were put together through an extensive stakeholder engagement process, plus a review of 2016 legislation from across the entire country. and then through various other processes, it was narrowed down to what you have in front of you today. And there are five major components. The first component has to do with the life-saving drug naloxone, which when given to someone who has essentially died from an opioid overdose will bring them back to life. It is a truly remarkable thing. I'm going to say a little bit about what's in the bill, and then Aaron Brown will address a little bit more why it matters so much. So this is largely a deletion of most of the components of our existing naloxone law, which sounds kind of draconian. But what it does is it basically eliminates the few remaining barriers to widespread availability of naloxone. Beginning in the 2013 session, this body has taken almost every session some move to increase the availability of naloxone. And in the Portland metro area, we have had no increase in the number of overdose deaths, despite what we think is a large increase in the use of heroin. And I personally attribute that to the efforts that you and others have made to making naloxone more available. This brings us in line with other states, which also have worked to make naloxone more available. We have, compared to other states, fairly heavy training requirements, and we also require physician oversight for agencies that want to have it. And again, not every nonprofit can kind of find a physician to oversee their training program. So this is basically a large simplification of that, and that is the Section 1 of this bill. Section 4 is sort of what I call the humanitarian measure. When someone stops using opioid drugs, they feel really, really sick. They start having diarrhea and sweating, and their pupils get big, and they can't go out in the light, and they just feel horrible. This is a step to just make sure that those people will get medical treatment for their withdrawal symptoms without any barriers from an insurer. Judge Block will talk more about Section 6 having to do with specialty courts, and again, this is a move toward making sure we have a rational approach to how we treat this chronic disease, which requires not only social and psychological supports, but also assistance from medication, just like any other chronic disease like asthma or diabetes. Section 7 has to do with making sure that addiction treatment information is up to date and easily available for people searching it. When I tried to find out what was actually available in our area, even though I was told it was the best in the state, it was not only very difficult to find, but it was not up to date and included people as directors that had little I know had moved out of the state a couple of years ago. So this is really intended to make sure that those suffering from this disease know where they can get treatment and what kind of treatment's available. It's also intended as what I call one of the accountability measures, is what is our system? What is available? The access is inadequate in the metro area, which has the best access in the state. And in other parts of the state, especially rural Oregon, there's essentially no effective addiction treatment. The final accountability measure has to do with annual or quarterly reporting of fatal and non-fatal overdoses. This is what you need to hold us accountable for in reducing this count. We can pull it off with the resources that we have in a well-funded local health department, but that's not possible for all 33 counties or 33 health departments covering the 36 Oregon counties. The technology is easily available. The Oregon Health Authority has a fantastic interactive website right now that tracks prescribing and deaths at a statewide level, and we would like this to be done more frequently and provided not only to you, the legislature, but also to those jurisdictions.
Thank you. Judge Block.
Chair and members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today regarding this critical public health and safety issue. I am currently serving as a circuit court judge in Multnomah County.
Your name on the record, Judge
Block.
Yes,
my name is Eric Block.
Thank you.
And I am a circuit court judge in Multnomah County for the past 15 years, and 12 of those 15 years I've had the privilege to serve as a judge presiding over one of our county's various specialty courts. I've just completed a stint as the presiding judge of one of our high-risk, high-need adult drug courts. It's called START, which stands for Success Through Accountability, Restitution, and Treatment. And thanks to the funding that this body has provided at a cost of $12 a day per participant, our court, with well over 150 participants, is functioning and working with individuals who, but for our court, would be in prison, costing the state $83 a day. I also am privileged to serve currently and for the past 4 years as the president of the Oregon Association of Drug Court Professionals, which is consisting of almost 200 members, judges, DAs, defense attorneys, probation officers, treatment counselors, and others. I've spoken on a number of occasions to members of the legislature about specialty courts. I don't know that I've had the opportunity to speak to everyone in the room, so I just thought I would briefly explain what we're talking about. when I use the term specialty court. It's a term that's been coined in Oregon law to refer to a wide array of therapeutic justice courts, including adult drug courts, which were the original variation on this model. And the second drug court in America was founded by Judge Harl Haas in Multnomah County. There are now well over 2,000 drug courts across America. We have mental health courts, we have DUII courts, juvenile dependency courts, family courts, and veterans courts. And while these courts target different populations, they all share certain characteristics. They're built on a collaborative approach where the courts, the district attorney, the defense, treatment, and probation all work together, sharing information and harnessing their respective authorities and expertise towards one supremely important goal, the safety of Oregon communities. Specialty courts seek to promote community safety that is durable, achieved through the recovery and the restoration of the individual court participant, rather than the often more temporary community safety offered through imprisonment and incapacitation of that individual. While participation in a specialty court is not right for every defendant in the criminal justice system and cannot be offered for every offense, it is often right for individuals in the system due to the disease of addiction and other behavioral and mental health disorders. Specialty courts are not simply about being nicer to defendants or, as the early detractors of drug courts used to say, giving hugs to thugs. It's not even simply about providing participants with needed resources, drug and mental health treatment, cognitive restructuring classes, housing, job training, and parenting classes. Specialty courts follow a particular model that was created and has been validated by the most extensive research and outcomes evidence ever assembled regarding any criminal justice program. The model relies upon sanctions and incentives applied to the right behaviors and delivered at the right times to promote participant compliance and accountability with probation and program requirements. This model for specialty courts over time initiates in the court's participants what we refer to as recovery, sobriety, pro-social habilitation, including work, and burgeoning integrity. In short, positive change, starting with stopping the use, and then through change within, learning how to not start again. Use of medication-assisted treatment in specialty courts is a best practice. It's a best practice according to the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, which is the national analog to the Oregon Association. It's comprised of over 3,000 members, and it is responsible for establishing and validating and researching drug court practices. And as you can see in the document that I have distributed, they have indicated that the essentiality of participants in specialty courts having access to medication-assisted treatment. Doing so is also consistent with federal guidelines and federal mandates that are increasingly coming to us through the funding mechanisms that are in part supporting our specialty courts here in Oregon and across the nation. The reason why medication to assist in recovery is so essential is simply this. Opiate addiction, as we've just heard, is a terrible thing. It's a disease that consumes the mind and body of the sufferer. Opiate addicts, and I see them every day in my court, are doing great harm. They're doing great harm to their bodies. They're doing great harm to their families. They're doing harm to their communities, and they're doing harm to the future that they might have and that we hope them to have as citizens of this state. They do things to obtain and use opiates that they would never do were they not suffering from this disease. And in doing so, they are digging a hole deeper and deeper. And there's an old adage, when you find yourself in a hole, thing one is to stop digging. Our experience in the court that I run, which is consistent with the research across the country, is that medication-assisted treatment can help the opiate addict stop using. Stopping is just part one of recovery. Part two, which is the far more difficult part, is to learn how to not start again. And that's why I say that medication-assisted treatment, whether it's methadone, whether it's Suboxone, Subutex, Vivitrol, while those things are necessary for some to stop, medication is not sufficient to complete the task of achieving long-term recovery. The medication must be provided through licensed healthcare practitioners and combined with a program of alcohol and drug treatment that is validated and mental health treatment where needed, and it is often needed, so that the individual can address the underlying issues that have contributed to their being in the situation they find themselves in. So medication-assisted treatment is important. It's a tool in our toolbox. Given the crisis that we face with opiate addiction in Multnomah County and across the state, we dare not, we cannot give up any tool in our toolbox. And medication-assisted treatment is particularly effective when it's used in a specialty court where there can be oversight and accountability for that individual to not stop with just the medication, but to follow through and engage in the ancillary services that combined with the medication will lead to long-term recovery. Thank you.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chairs McLean and Rayfield, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 3440. My name is Erin Brown, and I am the Syringe Exchange Coordinator for Multnomah County Health Department. In the 4 years since our naloxone law passed, Multnomah County Health Department and Outside In have been able to distribute over 10,000 doses of naloxone to people who inject drugs in the Portland area. As Dr. Lewis mentioned, not only have we seen overdoses not increase since the law was passed, there's been an almost 30% decrease in heroin deaths in Multnomah County once the bill was enacted from 2012 to 2013. We do think that naloxone distribution contributed to that decrease. It's remarkable because more people appear to be at risk for heroin overdose than ever before, and heroin deaths have increased dramatically in the rest of the United States. At the same time, there are still barriers to accessing naloxone in Oregon. We regularly work with agencies, not only in Multnomah County, but throughout Oregon, that are unable to distribute naloxone to their staff because of the current naloxone law's requirements for clinical oversight. For example, there are agencies that provide supportive housing in Portland where overdose is not uncommon, and who have been unable to provide staff with naloxone because they don't have physicians or nurse practitioners on staff to provide clinical oversight. As a result, those agencies have had to rely on their clients to step in and use their personal naloxone kits. We have also worked with law enforcement agencies and other social service agencies who have been delayed in supplying their officers with naloxone for the same reason. Naloxone is a safe drug and saves lives. It is not a scheduled drug or a controlled substance because there is no potential for abuse of naloxone. It is very easy to use and should not have a higher training threshold than any other prescription medication, for example, prescription opioids, which are much riskier. Restricting access to this drug is dangerous. Studies suggest that lay people are able to successfully use naloxone and save lives with minimal or no training. We support easing strict requirements around training as is written in the bill. Requiring naloxone-specific education may decrease the likelihood that prescribers will prescribe it or that pharmacies will sell it due to the shortage of time, and may decrease likelihood that end users will seek it. In Massachusetts, there was a study that compared three communities, one with no naloxone, one with some naloxone, and one with a lot of naloxone. The two communities that had naloxone had greater reductions in overdose deaths and hospitalizations than the community with no naloxone. But the community with the most naloxone had the biggest decreases in deaths and hospitalizations. We are grateful for the naloxone laws that have passed in Oregon. Being able to provide syringe exchange clients with naloxone has already saved countless lives. Most of the naloxone distribution in Oregon is taking place in and around Multnomah County. Rural Oregon already faces challenges in access to healthcare providers. Passing House Bill 3440 would allow for greater access to this life-saving drug. Thank you.
Thank you all. Questions for this panel? Representative Barreto.
Thank you. In reading through this, there's a couple things. Judge, you referred to it as a disease. Is it an addiction or a disease? And then in Oregon, it says, has one of the highest rates of prescription opioid misuse in the nation. And I wonder if this is from liberal prescriptions that we've been giving that we've caused this, or how we got to where we are.
Chair Williamson and Representative Barreto, I don't claim any expertise in the medicine. I'm simply using the term disease because I have read some studies which have identified that addiction is a disease of the brain. It changes the function and structure of the brain in a way that meets the definition of a disease. So I certainly would defer to Dr. Lewis for further comment on that issue. With respect to the overprescription of opiate medications, again, I can share with you the experience that I have had in my court. As you know, opiates are legal drugs to be prescribed, and I have had people in my court who are, permit me, suffering from the disease of addiction. It might be opiate addiction, but it might be some other addiction. We have methamphetamine addicts. We have all sorts of different people suffering from different particular forms of the disease. And they show up sometimes with prescriptions for opiates. And so what we thought to do, certainly not to prohibit it outright because we didn't feel it was appropriate to get between a patient and the doctor when it comes to a particular medical decision about whether to prescribe, but I thought it was appropriate that prescribing physician should at least be apprised when making a decision whether to prescribe opiates that this individual is in a drug court and is suffering from the disease of addiction. And so we have required our individual participants to apprise the physician of that fact. And nonetheless, they have obtained legal prescriptions from prescribers for opiates, even after telling the prescriber that they are in a drug court suffering from opiate addiction. Now, I don't have the medical expertise to say that was a wrong decision in that particular moment, but it is an interesting phenomenon that we're seeing. I have to say, in the past year to year and a half, the incidence of that happening has decreased, and I think it's decreased thanks to the efforts of folks who are sitting to my right and others who have really taken on the task of bringing greater awareness about this issue to the prescribing community.
Can I follow? Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I'm not here opposing anything. I'm just trying to get a better understanding.
Sure.
And then we have, and maybe you don't know this, but we had a task force that says in the spring of 2016 to develop statewide guidelines for clinicians and healthcare organizations. And then now this bill proposes another task force where it establishes a task force on opiate and opiate abuse and dependency for the purpose of studying opiate and opiate abuse and dependency. So same task force or is this a new one?
In the amendment, there's no task force. It was
okay.
Taken out.
Okay. Thank you.
And I just for the committee, the reason this is in rules is I've been working with Multnomah County on these issues for years, and determining what the next step was in the series of bills that this legislature has passed in the last 4-6 years on naloxone. It took us a while to hammer it all out, and so we wanted to make sure that we got it right, and that's why we are hearing it in this committee.
Mm-hmm. May I add to that, Madam Chair? Because in rules, my first experience here in rules, we are hearing a lot of bills that we don't have a lot of background on, you know, and for this to come down from healthcare, you know, down to us on this committee, and we haven't had the time, you know, to go to the experts that we have in our caucus on healthcare, you know, so there are just a lot of things that get thrown at us that we don't fully understand. So.
Well, and Representative Bretta, we are not moving this bill today. So I want to give a little bit of time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Great. Yes, I want to thanks again for having us. And I want to thank Representative Kennemer and Representative Williamson for co-sponsoring this bill. I really appreciate it. It's a long road. We need a lot of help.
Thank you. Thank you for all the work that you do. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3440. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2342.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2342 was originally heard on the 9th. I will call your attention to the -4 amendment on the measure. The -4 amendment replaces the underlying measure and permits the Department of Consumer and Business Services, upon recommendation of the Health Insurance Exchange Advisory Committee, to adopt temporary rule that may not be readopted in whole or in part that is not in compliance with state law governing health insurance. If the following conditions exist: there is a change in federal law on or after September 1st, 2017, that is expected to cause premium rates previously approved by DCBS to no longer meet requirements on the individual market, is expected to have a substantial impact on the average out-of-pocket costs for or premiums paid by insureds in this state, or decision made by U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Internal Revenue Service, or U.S. Department of Labor to discontinue or reduce federal payments for cost sharing for or premiums paid by insured in Oregon. Rules adopted as permanent may not be in effect for longer than 6 months unless ratified by action of the Legislative Assembly. If DCBS adopts rules under this act, DCBS must immediately report with full explanation of action taken to Senate President, Speaker of the House, and interim committees related to health. DCBS must submit quarterly reports to committees related to health on impact of action on insurance market and consumer. This authority is repealed on July 1, 2019. There is an emergency clause on this measure. We have received a no fiscal impact. We are just waiting for the revenue on the -4 amendment.
Next, do you want to come up?
Well. Great. Thank you, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I won't go over things we talked about on Tuesday. Just quickly to the -4 amendments. What we've tried to construct here is a bridge, or in the words of Representative Kennemer has used, a lifeboat that is intended to give us a way to get through sudden destabilizing changes in federal law, particularly when they fall outside the rate setting process or when they fall outside times that you are here and able to legislate to deal with changes in the federal system. After Tuesday's hearing, we worked with legislative counsel to figure out how to further constrain this a bit, and what we've come up with are some increased findings where our agency would need to make a finding that what's going on it affects the life and health of Oregonians, so loss of health insurance and the impacts that that has. But most importantly, it cuts this back to basically a single six-month period that we can enact some kind of a non-compliant rule, or rule that's different than what statute says. And if that change needs to last longer than 6 months, it would require legislation. So whether it's, if we're talking special session or getting to the February short session or full session or whatever, gives us a chance to bridge our way through whatever the immediate destabilizing problem is. Two other quick comments. This isn't without risk, and I think Mr. Johnson will speak to that. This is the kind of thing where someone could challenge a rule under this basis. We've tried to see if we can constrain or try to mitigate that risk with some of the sideboards that are here. The last thing, just because it came up in a couple of conversations with you, this is solely about the commercial insurance market. This does not implicate Medicaid, the OHA budget, state financial obligations, anything like that. This is solely about the relationship between private insurance companies, their insureds, and providers. So there's not a state resource implication one way or another in any of this. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Dexter.
Chair Williamson, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And I think the question that we have been asked is whether this amendment, because it does provide that it authorizes an agency to act very inconsistently with existing state law under certain circumstances, whether that's constitutional. And we think it is, but there is significant risk that a strong argument could be made, successfully made, that it in fact is not constitutional. We analogize this to the existing public health laws, where under existing law, the governor can declare a public health emergency and suspend certain laws that are otherwise applicable for a limited period of time. And the justification there is that there's some kind of emergency going on that endangers the that is likely to cause death or serious injury or illness if action isn't taken immediately. And this situation, you'll note that this bill, one of the criteria that must apply for the department to be able to have this rulemaking authority is that the insurance market be so destabilized that risk of life and health of residents is in effect. So in that sense, we think it is analogous to the public health emergency provisions. And also we note that this is limited in duration to a 6 month period. That is long. The public health statutes provide for as long as a 28-day suspension. This is longer than that, so there's some risk there as well. Again, the theory is that these are emergency situations where something must be done. The Constitution, of course, provides for a special session procedure for the legislature to address things, but special sessions take some time to pull together. And so in the public health statutes, it's limited to its 28-day period. This pushes the envelope on that, but still limits the duration of these measures to a limited period of time so that the legislature can come in and address more substantively whatever the problem is.
Questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you also clarify, there's an end date, I believe, that then the measure is no longer valid, is that?
That's correct. It has a sunset.
Which is?
It's July 1, 2019.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank both of you for working on this. I had concern that with the uncertainty of what's going to happen in healthcare, at the federal level, it creates a problem for us, and how do we adjust that? And it seems ultimately that's a responsibility of the legislature. But acting immediately is not usually an attainable action from the legislature. So I think this, from my view, was a reasonable compromise, and I appreciate the work at putting this 6-month limit on it. And the non-renewable clause, I think, makes a lot of sense. And if it's going to endure beyond 6 months, then the legislature will need to reconvene and rule as it wishes. So I appreciate the good effort.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Dexter. The delegation authority that you are opining to this agency is rooted in a public emergency. Did I hear that correct?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, yes, in the public health emergency, existing law allows the governor to declare such an emergency when there's risk of substantial death or disease or that sort of thing.
May I follow up? So, but to conclude that, would I be correct in surmising that changes in health insurance are therefore analogous to acts which put people's life or health in danger?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, yes, that is one of the findings that must be made, is that changes in the health insurance market be such that it causes life or health of Oregonians to be placed at risk. And what the mechanics of that are, I either have to defer here or to Chief Deputy Legislative Counsel Lori Freeman, who's also here and knows a lot more about the mechanics of that than I do.
Could I, if I could speak to that briefly, an example that comes to mind for me would be something that caused a widespread collapse and withdrawal from the market of insurance companies that impacted ongoing treatment for cancer or other kinds of non-acute diseases. Would seem to me to be the kind of a thing that would put someone's life at risk. And there are things that we could envision that could change suddenly at the federal level that potentially could have that kind of an effect.
Well, Mr. Allen, that's a very political statement. And I'm quite surprised you would sit here and make that. And, you know, we're talking about the delegation of constitutional authority. And just because of that answer, what you're saying is that there could be an instance where the entire insurance market would collapse. And I would hope that if that happened, that would merit a special session. Do you have anything other than the world is coming to end to justify us handing you, through some delegated power, the legislative authority of the state?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, I apologize if what I said struck you as a political comment. It certainly wasn't intended that way. What we're trying to do right now in working with the insurance industry and other stakeholders is try to figure out how to provide enough confidence in the future stability of the insurance market, A, to ensure that companies continue for 2018 especially to provide policies in Oregon, and B, give some sense of the ability to react quickly in the face of sudden changes. And I apologize if it sounds political, but hardly a week goes by that there's not some kind of a suggestion of a sudden dramatic change to the landscape that insurers are dealing in. The most recent, last week, the head of the Office of Management and Budget was asked about the payment of cost-sharing reductions, and his answer was to the effect of, we pay those on the 20th of the month. Check with me then, and I'll tell you whether we're going to pay them for May or not. That's a pretty dramatic kind of a circumstance, and that's, I think, what we're really trying to be responsive to. And again, really trying to be able to assure for 2018 that we've got access to companies. They're looking at this dynamic right now in Washington. Oregon companies are, and really they want to be in this market, but they struggle with that instability. And so this is an attempt to really try to provide some kind of an opportunity to respond quickly to sudden changes, to give them that comfort to be in the market so that all of your constituents have got access to multiple companies, which is what we're really trying to do.
Yeah, I follow up with the good director. Director, did you or anyone in your agency seek this kind of power during the presidency of Barack Obama?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, we actually began work on a number of...
I appreciate you giving the history, but did you, yes or no?
We began, if I could finish, we began to work last spring on a package of stability concepts, regardless of what the election results were, to try to work to stabilize the insurance market in Oregon.
May I follow up? Yes. You know, Director, if the disaster you fear came upon us, then it sounds to me like it would merit a special session. But I for one, am quite surprised that this effort has become so political. And it's very disappointing to see you sit there and play into what is a national political narrative and seek this sort of delegated authority. Very surprised at you, sir.
Representative Kenemer.
I guess I see this response as a response to my request, and I appreciate the committee, and I appreciate Mr. Allen and counsel working on trying to find a solution. It seems to me, and I mean, my background is in the healthcare field, but certainly not in insurance that much, except complaining about it. But it seems to me that there is uncertainty about the future and that there are going to be some changes, whether Obamacare goes away or something else replaces it or what happens. And I guess in that uncertainty, that's why I ask for an intervening step. Part of my experience in the legislative process, I'm in the midst of my 19th year of service, is that I've seen a variety of special sessions, some of which were phenomenally bad and some of which were, I think, very effective. And it seems to me that ones that are short and effective have a moment of homework done so that when we meet, we've had parties having a chance to find common ground. And at least this is my endeavor to see if that's what we can find. It seems to me that this we have entrusted DCBS, and different people have different opinions, but to have authority in these areas, it seems to me that they are also the right conveners for at least an initial effort to solve it. And I like the 6-month term. It gives a time to see if there is going to be stabilization and gives us a chance to look at what's going on. So I guess that's sort of my view and why I requested it, and I frankly am still of the view either way, it's got potential problems, and this may not be the ideal solution. But I also think it's nice when you know a problem is coming or think it's likely to come to have a plan of action. And that's why I have supported and asked for this amendment.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Dexter. You had mentioned previously that, you know, the constitutionality that, you know, when there's a threat to life or public health, that the governor could declare, you know, a health emergency, which would enable something like this to be able to happen under the law. So in this bill, the Director of Department of Consumer Business Services being an agent of the governor qualifies for that declaration by the governor?
Chair Williamson, Representative Holvey, yes, in either instance, it's an example where the legislature has passed a law that allows the executive branch to supersede under limited circumstances where life and health are at risk, to supersede what other inconsistent law for a limited period of time.
So just to be clear, the bill doesn't mention the governor, but DCBS being part of the governor's executive branch would be able to do that. I guess does it take the governor's signature or not?
It does not. From a constitutional standpoint, we believe the governor represents the executive branch. DCBS is part of the executive branch. Constitutionally, it's the same thing. And I will note again that this is not without risk. We think it likely, but not completely certain that this will work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too asked about the amendment, so I do appreciate the work that has been done on that. And you know, a lot of my reasoning behind that were concerns expressed by my fellow colleagues. But you know, I don't want to see anybody lose medical coverage. But I also am curious what Representative Holvey just raised, and I was thinking that myself. If what you had said, Dexter, that typically a governor declares this type of an emergency. Is there a way that this may again be amended or looked at to say that the governor would declare the emergency first, take the responsibility of that, and then have to sign off on whatever it is that DCBS does? The 6 months still applies. It still comes back to the legislature, and there's still the cap.
Chair Williamson, Representative Hack, yes, the bill could be redrafted to provide for that.
And follow up. If that were the case, would there still be the risks that you feel that there are now, or would there be less risk if the governor were to be put in a position to take responsibility?
I think legally the risk would not be changed.
Thank you.
Questions? Representative Rayfield.
During the last hearing, Cambia had come up here, and I know you've been working with the insurance industry, and they were okay with the initial bill as drafted. The last session, I assume they're okay and all on board and supportive of this amendment?
Yes, Chair Williamson, Representative Rayfield, we've looped back with the same stakeholders and vetted it, and they continue to be supportive.
Stand at ease for a second. Any additional questions? Otherwise, I'll take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 2342.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the -4 amendments into House Bill 2342. Is there any discussion? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, I'm going to be a no.
I'm thankful that this amendment came forward from Representative Hack and Kinnemer. This sort of delegation is going to pass, and it appears that it has the votes, then at least it will be limited to 6 months, which so I'll vote for that amendment and then reserve my opposition to the bill in the notion of delegation of this sort of authority. Vote no on the underlying bill. I disagree with the analysis of its legality, and I am quite astonished at the director's comments and politicalization of this.
Additional discussion. Sam, can you call the roll?
Representative Barreto?
No.
Representative Hack?
Yes.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Yes. Motion passes.
And Madam Chair, for the record, members, we did receive a no revenue impact on the -4 amendment.
Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2342 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 2342 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Sam, can you call the roll? Thank you.
Representative Barreto?
No.
Yes.
Aye.
Representative Kenmore?
Aye.
Representative Nope?
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean?
No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair McLean?
Yes. Motion passes. Carrier, Representative Nose.
Oh, really?
I'm just reading the paper. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2342.
Question period. Let no deed go unpunished.
Eat your Wheaties.
So we're going to carry it. Carry over this one. That's what my thing is. So, colleagues, we are going to carry over House Bill 2893 to Tuesday. And with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2122A.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2122A requires new or existing coordinated care organization that transfers ownership to have 501c3 status and that governing bodies meetings are subject to public meetings laws. It directs the CCOs to expend all earnings that exceed financial requirements on services to address health disparities and social determinants of health as outlined in CCO's community health improvement plan. Has an emergency clause on the measure. We have an A24 amendment, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The A24 amendment requires community advisory council meetings to be open to the public. Governing board meetings will be subject to the recording and written meetings requirements and deletes the public meeting requirement. Deletes the grandfathering in for for-profit CCOs. If a CCO enters the new contract, you must change your for-profit to nonprofit or become a public benefit corporation by the end of 5 years. Add CCOs to report annually to Oregon Health Authority of their financial information and specifies requirements. We have a no revenue on the A24s. We are awaiting the fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good to see you. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. It's good to be back talking further about House Bill 2122. We're here to discuss the A24 amendments. Before I go through the amendments, you know, I never thought I would spend a lot of time on this bill. But the more time I've spent with it, and I want to thank Representative Greenlick for pursuing this, not just this year, but last year. You know, I think Representative Greenlick and I feel a little like parents. We were there when transformation got off the ground. And I want to just restate for the record and for the public that this bill is not about good or bad actors today. We have CCOs who are making progress. We have more progress to be made. I think there are a lot of people working really hard to do the right thing, provide quality care, to manage the cost trend, and do the right thing for the Oregon Health Plan. This is about the future. This is about where we're going to be in 5 years. This is where we're going to be in the next contract period. And this is about setting standards for the next contract period. This is about, you know, controlling our destiny somewhat, about how healthcare for members of the Oregon Health Plan is administered and provided. And so I want to just put that out front so we can keep that in mind as we go through this conversation. So Section 1 of the A24s, I'm going to go through what they do. If you have questions about how it's different, maybe we'll do that at the end. But I just want to make sure everyone understands since we're on the 24s. Section 1 requires CCOs to spend a portion of their annual net income or reserves that exceed the financial requirements. So this is not about required reserves. This does not mean administrative funds, funds spent on medical care, or required restricted reserves. This is about a portion of annual net income or reserves that exceed financial requirements being dedicated to social determinants of health as determined by the community improvement plan. In Section 3, how you set those that portion will be set through in rule. Section 3 puts that out there for consideration. Section 3 means that by the rulemaking process, the authority working with stakeholders will take into consideration the variability of each CCO's operating budget, their obligations, investments, risk-sharing arrangements, need for infrastructure improvements, and the like. We heard that every CCO is a little different. They all have required reserves, and then they have other ways of how they do business, and so this seemed like a better way to go about trying to figure out how you would set that additional portion of net income to be dedicated to the community improvement plan. We've also included in Section 3 that DCBS is in the process where applicable. they have a large role to play in terms of setting reserves and whatnot, and so we want that expertise. Back to Section 1. Section 1 also incorporates language from the Dash 10 amendments, which, as you recall, came from the CCOs themselves. And notably, the Section 1 also includes a lot of the language represented by Representative McLean in his amendments 18 through 21. This is the section about how we have more transparency and accountability. This isn't, as you recall, this amendment does not talk about governing board meetings being subject to public meeting laws. 24s take out all requirements on public meeting laws for the governance boards of the CCOs. But what it does require is that a current or former member of a CCO, who's also on the Community Advisory Council, to be placed on the governing board. Okay. It requires governing boards to have a clear mechanism in place to ensure activities of the governing board are reported to the community advisory councils of the CCO, requires each CCO to make publicly available the name and contact information for a chairperson of the governing board and either a member of the CAC or employee of the CCO, and requires at least one joint CAC and governing board meeting be open to the public. And it adds, and this is where we get to the additional transparency piece since we're not doing open meetings now, it adds that all governing board meetings be subject to written minute requirements per ORS 192.650 and for these minutes to be available on each CCO website. So what you see in the Dash 24s is a recognition that the argument that having open meetings and boards could stifle innovation. We want transparency and accountability, so publish minutes, more communication, and at least one joint open public meeting with the community advisory group and the board in the course of a year. So more transparency, but recognizing that open meetings for boards might have caused some issues. Section 2 of the bill requires that all CCOs be nonprofit or benefit corporations under ORS Chapter 65 by January 1, 2023. So within the last year of the next five-year contract, a CCO would have to either be a C3 or a benefit corporation. The point here being, we believe for greater accountability and transparency of the management of large sums of public money, that having a investment stakeholder for-profit motivation and how things are managed could be a challenge, and so we want CCOs to transition to being nonprofits or benefit corporations. This is different than the previous amendment in that it doesn't, this would mean current CCOs, if they entered into a five-year contract, would be, have to, by the last year of that five-year contract, have to be a nonprofit or be corp. In Section 5 of the Dash J24, again, more transparency and accountability around financial interactions. This is also language, I believe they came straight out of the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations. Requires CCOs to annually report to OHA the financial information that includes each CCO's profit margin, medical and non-medical costs, investments and payments made to partner organizations, activities of the governing board and community advisory council, and requires OHA to post this information on the website. This is directly from the Dash 10 amendments that the CCO submitted and mirrors the suggestions in amendments 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22. In Section 8, again, the language from the Dash 10s from the CCOs requires CCOs to develop a plan to move toward greater utilization of alternate payment methodologies, and we do not, in this amendment, require or prescribe how those alternative payment methodologies should look. So in general, you see greater alignment with the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations in the A24s. You also hopefully hear testimony today that we have public support from at least six of the CCOs. A couple are also not opposed, but not necessarily on the letter today. We believe this will ensure transparency and accountability going forward with our CCOs, while also protecting them to continue to do good work and innovate into the future. And I encourage your support of the E24s.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just would like to make a very brief statement. This has been a long process from House Bill 4100 in the 2016 session. Every piece of the bill has been changed in one way or another. Every piece of the bill has come from the recommendations of one or the other of the CCOs. I'd like to thank the Speaker for facilitating these conversations in a way that I think have been very fruitful. You'll see movement from some of the CCOs toward at least neutrality. They don't love the bill. I frankly don't love the bill in this form, but I think what it does is move us forward in a way that as we go in to the next round of discussions with the CCOs, we'll be having a much more sustainable and perhaps even more rational discussion than we've had in the past. Oh, I would urge your forbearance with an imperfect bill that I think does enough good to make it worthwhile moving forward.
Representative Greenlee, can you say your name for the record?
For the record.
Can you say your name for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm new at this game.
I know. Clearly.
I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlee, House District 33.
Thank you. Representative Kenemer.
Madam Speaker, you were talking about the origins of this. Were you referencing House Bill 2009 in 2009, or which, where was that?
Oh, Madam Chair, no. Representative Kenemer, the whole thing. I mean, yeah. Pick a bill. There were several bills
together. 3650 was sort of the main formal in the 2011 session.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to decide which one it was. I guess, you know, I was reflecting back, excuse me, pardon me, I babbled on. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I was reflecting back that in 2009, I had just entered the House of Representatives and was on health care committee. And we had some pretty long deliberations about things in 2009 and also 11. One of the discussions that I remember was a substantial discussion about the nature of these CCOs, whether they would be profit or nonprofit. And one of the deciding factors in my support was the fact that we were going to experiment and see, and that we would do both. And that's why I'm having trouble with this amendment. It seems to me that this is premature, and that we have evidence that the profitable, the for-profit, are providing equal or at least equal service. And so I'm having a hard time with this. It seems to me that we started out with the notion that it would be an experiment, and I'd like to see it on for a while longer to see whether or not it, which is the better model.
Madam Chair, Representative Kenemer, I appreciate that comment. I don't know if there's just exactly the right response to that question. I think I want to be clear that what we are talking about is the governance of the CCO. You could have all for-profit partners engaged in a CCO, but the governance of the CCO organization itself that manages the money, makes decisions, helps drive quality, is a nonprofit or B corporation entity. And the purpose being there is, I think one of the challenges we have as public stewards is to make sure that we can do everything we can to hold our contractors accountable. This is a really unique situation. This is a lot of money. And there's a lot of good things happening. Again, this isn't about something specifically not going right, but I think it's very difficult sometimes to explain to the public when you're talking about a social good like healthcare, when you're talking about a public good like healthcare that's not just, you know, a widget off a shelf, what the necessity of having for-profit intent in the governance of this type of structure. And so we're just saying that I think from a public's perception standpoint, getting to a B corporation or nonprofit status by the end of the next contract is the right way to go.
If I may, Madam Chair, the really interesting because I still get flashbacks to 2011 where I was working on the development of 3650. And there were two models that were put forward in the development of 3650. One was we would start community-based 501c3 organizations. The other is we would take the MCOs, the medical care organizations that were available, and sort of have an MCO on steroids. Because we were a split legislature at that time, a split house, we really didn't say, let's create some experiments. We really said, let's do both because we can't decide which one is the right one. I think you're right. I think we still, there's still time on this experiment, but we're talking about this as taking place 6 years from now in 2023. Yeah. if we decide between now and then that we're not going in the right direction, we still will have time to change it. But if we are going to go in this direction, we thought it would be important to give the existing CCOs the opportunity to move in one way or another. They've already begun to move in some, including becoming B Corps.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, and I appreciate Representative Greenlick. I perhaps was a little generous in my characterization. I think maybe it was more, let's do both since we can't figure out to do one. On the other hand, I do remember distinctly the conversation about this also offers an opportunity to see how they perform.
Yes.
I guess I'd have just an additional comment. Perhaps it's more of a personal experience comment because I've run a counseling center, started a couple, and I think there is something to be said about public input. I also think in situations like healthcare where there is so much confidential information. And there are so many different sensitive documents. I think having a governance from a public body subject to public meetings law is impractical and probably unworkable in, from my perspective and in my experience.
We are not subjecting even the public bodies in this to the public meeting laws under the Dash 24.
I'm sorry?
I say even our nonprofit 501c3s are not subject to public meeting laws under the Dash 24s.
Okay, maybe I missed that. Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Speaker Kotek, you had mentioned taxpayer dollars and people basically not profiting off of the taxpayer dollars or the public funds. And yet we're talking about, I think, an $8 billion transportation package where we will have a lot of contractors if it's passed. There'll be a lot of contractors basically profiting off of taxpayer dollars. Is there a distinction that you make between healthcare and between other private contractors that work for the state?
Madam Chair and Representative Barreto, in the creation of the coordinated care organizations, the goal was to provide access to quality care and bend the cost curve at the 3.4%, which we've instituted in terms of the budgets. I think it's what we're trying to do with this is say we don't want a competing interest in meeting those goals. And I do think healthcare is a different product, if you would, than building a bridge. And so, so that's what I can say on that.
Have a follow up. So in the private sector, they say competition breeds excellence. And so when you have competition, those two entities, three or four, competing against each other for the market, and the better value that the people get, those companies that provide the better value are the ones that will excel. So last week when we heard this bill, I think the question was asked, is the care any different between the for-profits and the non-profits? And I think the answer was no. The quality is just as good. If the quality was even better in the for-profits, and yet they're still working on the same, they still get the money from the public sector, but they're producing a better product for greater value, and people then they start taking a little greater share of the market. Is that a bad thing?
Madam Chair and Representative Barreto, this bill isn't about metrics, and we're not having a quality conversation. We're having a conversation, in my mind, around transparency and accountability. And I don't believe market competition applies with how these have been set up.
Follow up. But in the private sector, you can still have transparency, and you can still have quality. It could still be measured regardless of whether it's public or private, just as they are right now.
And Chair, if I may, I think the difference in this situation is that these are creatures essentially set up to serve a particular function. They're not competing in the same way we are in the transportation package, they're essentially living with a budget that we've predetermined, and that's the budget, and that's what they're doing. The in the transportation package, we have a contract that we offer, and people compete for it, but that hasn't basically isn't the case in the CCOs.
I have a follow-up. So, but they work on Medicaid dollars, right? I mean, the model Apparently that we Medicaid had prior to this seemed like the clinics and the hospitals needed a certain portion of individual health insurance or care in order to make up for the low margins that they would make, or maybe no margins that they would make on Medicaid. And so here come the CCOs, kind of an experiment, and yet they're doing very well on the Medicaid, the amount that the government pays for Medicaid. And so you have a new model here that seems to be doing well, much better than the other model, and yet if we're when we had people that, you know, kind of took a risk, they went out and they said, yeah, I think we'd like to try this, and maybe even took a cut in pay to start up these CCOs, and now here they are later doing very well, and now we say, but we want to put limitations on them. And then I also, we talked about reserves, and when we talk about the nonprofit, it seems like we talked about what they made on these in reserves. The for-profits, we called that profit. And so my question is, the reserves from the nonprofits, are they about the same as the profits from the for-profit CCOs?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, all of the CCOs have, I think surplus is a better word. After they've paid their claims and met their reserves, it depends on the CCO. And that is somewhat dealt with in the conversation about setting by rule some way to make sure that the additional leftovers, as I would say, are going back into the community, which was the expectation when these were created.
Follow up. So are the leftovers about the same in both of them, whether we call them reserves or whether we call them profits? Because they need some level of reserve. Is that correct? Okay. So beyond those reserves for each of them, one would be profit, one would be more reserves. And the other thing is it seems like even in a nonprofit, they can pay the people that are working in that nonprofit as much as they want to, as long as they come out the other end with the reserve and with no profit then. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, I would say yes on that. Just, you know, just because someone's nonprofit doesn't mean that they're doing everything right. I think what you have to look at this bill is the combination of all of this, looking at how a portion of net income or reserves is available to go back in the community, increased financial reporting, the movement towards a governance structure that provides more accountability in the sense that you're not competing with a profit motive at the end of the five-year contract. So I think you want to take this as a whole. And every CCO is a little different, and so we're trying to make sure that we're bringing them all forward with more transparency and accountability.
One last follow-up. But cannot the for-profit corporations give you the same transparency and accountability?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, I don't believe so.
Yes. I just want to put on the record that these entities, they're regional, and with only one exception, they don't really compete against each other, and the one exception is in the Tri-County area where there are two CCOs, and I'm not sure competition is the right word, but there are two CCOs, and they do operate differently and do, you know, receive clients and all that in a different, but then to say that they're in strict competition with each other is also probably not accurate. They sort of get assigned patients based on, so one is not favored over the other.
Can I ask the representative here a question?
Yes.
So do they compete with hospitals in the area? Do the hospitals then in those areas not take Medicaid patients?
And so, believe me, I've spent 4 years on the healthcare committee, and I'm still barely getting an understanding of how they operate and how they work. But I think the easiest way to think of them as these are mini insurance companies, and they contract to provide medical services in an area that they serve. So think of them like an insurance company. And then if I'm the insurance company, they contract with all of you, either because you're a doctor or you're a dentist or you're a nurse practitioner or a counseling service, and that's how they operate. And then patients receive care based on who they go to. It's about the only way I can explain it.
Questions?
If I could, I think Representative Nose, there certainly is competition when the CCO contract is being awarded. So I think that is fair enough to give credence to Representative Barreto's comments.
Thank you. So Jesse O'Brien, John Mullins, John Eames.
Yeah, helpful.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, statewide consumer advocacy group. I will try to be brief because I know there are a number of other people signed up, and it's already rather late in the day. But I'm here in enthusiastic support of House Bill 2122. I think it's an important step forward for Oregon's efforts to transform the healthcare system to contain costs, improve care, and improve the health of Oregonians. We support the I can't believe I'm going to say this, but the -A24 amendments. And I would like to draw your attention to a letter that is available on OLIS. It was signed on to by nine consumer and healthcare advocacy organizations in support of the bill, although you'll note that the letter refers to the -A14 amendments. This is because we were not able to circle back with everybody who signed on to the letter to get their sign-off on the new amendments because we just received them. So I can't speak on their behalf. I can say that OSPIRG supports the new amendments and that I think this letter helps show that there is broad community support for moving in this direction, in the direction of greater transparency, accountability for CCOs, and making sure that CCOs are genuinely responsive to consumer and community needs and accountable to Oregon taxpayers. I will say I'm quite disappointed to see that the public meeting provisions have been taken out of the bill in the -A24 amendments. I think that that is a significant concession and a significant step back from the original bill, but we do still believe that it's a step forward from the status quo, and we urge your yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I believe all the members are familiar with the Oregon Law Center's mission and working on behalf of low-income people. We have been involved going way back in the discussion about the Oregon Health Plan coming into existence, Medicaid expansion, transformation, creation of the CCOs. And I would just like to say that at the outset, I'm very much in favor of when House Bill 3650 passed, about the values that were written into that bill and about the idea about integrating services of physical, behavioral health, and oral health. I think everybody would acknowledge that we haven't quite reached all of the ambitious goals that we have about transformation. But I'm here today to support House Bill and with 2122 with the -24 amendments. And I also want to underscore something that Representative Greenlick said, that it's there are many issues about the bill that he wished were stronger. We also commented on a number of things that didn't make its way into the bill, about things that we would have liked to have seen. But I just want to just end with a little brief discussion of a community forum we had with the Allies for a Healthier Oregon, a group that Mr. O'Brien and I helped to form back when. And this was in October. We had over 100 people that participated in the discussion about CCOs. And I think the overriding issue was about the fact that we are all supporting transformation going forward, but there are improvements that could be made. Coming from consumers themselves, there was discussion about transparency and accountability measures. And I agree with Mr. O'Brien about the public meeting issue. but I am encouraged about the fact that this community advisory committees will have an open process. I think that in the end, I think as we look back at this bill, if it passes, I think we'll come to see this as an improvement that was inclusive of many points of view, and while not a perfect bill, is a good bill going forward, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm here on behalf of HealthSure, which is a not-for-profit CCO serving the Multnomah and Washington Clackamas County area, and we serve about 200,000 OHP recipients. I just have a 20-minute video I want to show. I'm just kidding.
Turn the lights out.
Mr. Ballack's going to come. Mr. Ballack's going to come.
Are there puppies in the video?
No. Just a little levity at the end of the day here on Thursday. We wanted to come and testify today to testify our support of the Dash H-24 amendments. This has been a long process indeed. There's been a variety of different twists and turns to how this language has been brought before you today. However, what we believe is that the language that's been presented in the H-24s has moved very close to where the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations that is posted on OLIS has recommended. While the Oregon Health Policy Board did not recommend exact legislative changes, the elements of what were included in the Oregon Health Policy Board are reflected much more closely in the A24s. So we want to and appreciate the work that's gone into this from both Representative Greenlick and Speaker Kotek to get us to this point. It's never easy in the legislative process to go through this, but we have appreciated the changes that they have made to get us to where we are today. And we urge your support for the bill and with the amendment.
Representative McLean.
Yes, is it Mr. O'Brien? You stated that this bill would leave to improved care in your opening remarks. Do you have any evidence or know of any where for-profit companies are providing less care than a nonprofit company?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, my remarks were not meant to imply that there's a distinction in the care between those two kinds of entities. It was more that I think that the requirements in the bill around spending the excess reserves on actual community health needs and addressing health disparities, I think, will lead to better care for Oregon communities. I think those provisions are very important.
May I follow up? You said that this bill would be, quote, responsive to Oregon taxpayers, end quote. What do you mean by that statement?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, what I mean is that I think it is somewhat difficult for Oregon taxpayers to currently have as much information about how CCOs are spending the quite substantial funds that they are receiving from Oregon taxpayers. I think that having CCO board meetings open to the public would have been a really excellent way of providing a window into that and providing community members and taxpayers with a way of providing input into those decisions. I think that the A24 amendments, which step back from that a little bit, still provide some window into it by requiring written materials from the board meetings to be made available and requiring additional financial reporting from CCOs.
And may I last one? Is it the position of Osberg that there is a difference in care at all provided by a for-profit and a nonprofit?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, that is not our position. And I would say in my experience that the the difference between nonprofit and for-profit organizations in healthcare across the board is not as big as I think most people would expect. I would say, for instance, I once had an interview with a reporter who asked me which of Oregon's health insurance companies were for-profit and which were not-for-profit. And the first thing that occurred to me is that it's kind of amazing that you would have to ask that question. So what I would say is I think that the distinction between nonprofit and for-profit in healthcare isn't always as strong as people might think that it is. But what it does do is it provides a certain set of tools to hold organizations accountable. I don't think those tools are sufficient, but I think that including them in this bill is an important step toward holding these organizations accountable.
Then can I ask one last question? Do you believe that a provider to under our Medicaid health plan from a for-profit entity competes with a profit motive and providing care?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, I'm not totally sure that I understand the thrust of your comments. I think that for-profit entities, you know, are seeking profit as part of their mission, which is totally reasonable. We have no objection to that. Nonprofit entities do so as well in order to bring in additional money that they can use to fund expanding on their mission, and that's also entirely fine. And I think providers are motivated by a desire to provide health care to people. I'm not sure if that answers the question.
I think it makes my point. Thank you.
Back. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if you're at all concerned that there may be a possibility that by limiting the scope or the availability to open a CCO to a nonprofit, that may actually keep additional CCOs from opening, which would then hinder the ability for us to provide additional care to folks who may need it in the future.
I could take a crack at it, I suppose. Chair Williamson, Representative Hack, I think that, I guess I would say I'm not sure whether I see a strong consumer interest in there being a bunch of additional CCOs, since we now have CCOs covering basically all regions of the state. I certainly think that if there were additional organizations that wanted to come in and provide care in a different way, that could potentially be a good thing. But I think the more important thing is making sure that we hold the organizations that are currently serving Oregonians in this way accountable, and this bill takes a big step in the direction of doing that.
Have we done our due diligence in checking with the current CCOs to make sure that they aren't overloaded, that they are able to meet the capacity and the needs of those that are currently being served? I know that when we've had some of the presentations in healthcare from OHA, the number of folks that are on, that are bouncing on and off of coverage, and I mean, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done there, and folks that should be covered that aren't covered, we've got a lot of issues with that. So have we done our due diligence in making sure that we don't need more CCOs?
Chair Williams and Representative Hack, I think our friends from the CCOs can speak to that with more authority than okay. I can. I would say from what I hear from our members and other folks in the healthcare community, there are some capacity issues with CCOs, but they have more to do with the availability of providers in a lot of parts of the state, as well as the adequacy of services to do things like process enrollment and re-enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan, more so than the actual number of CCOs available.
I'd probably more of a comment than I think that while the transparency is good and we obviously want to make sure that we're doing right by taxpayer dollars, I also think that it's extremely important that we're providing enough care for the people that need it. And so I look forward to hearing from the CCOs. I don't think that that was a question that necessarily was raised during our healthcare committee, so I'd like to hear from them, because I think at the end of the day, we have a responsibility to make sure that we certainly don't stifle growth if we need it, and that we're able to provide the care for all Oregonians that may need that in the future. Thank you. I appreciate your comments.
All right. Thank you very much. Art Sikowski, Charlie Swanson, and Courtney Johnson.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chairs McLean and Rayfield, and members of the committee. I'm Charlie Swanson, a democracy and healthcare advocate from Lane County. I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 2122, the Dash 24 amendments. I'm going to begin with a fictional story. In 1996, a group of people, primarily physicians, but including a few businessmen, worked to establish an innovative public health care agency to serve low-income Oregonians. In their efforts, they gave up a few weeks' worth of salary to establish the agency, a risk they accepted. In an interesting arrangement, the state gave these people total control of the agency through a governing board. These people continued their other employment, but spent some time directing this agency. In 2011, the state changed how federal and state Medicaid funds were dispersed, and put this agency in control of nearly all the Medicaid dollars for that county, designating the agency a community organization, even though they governed behind closed doors. The state set up a system of metrics to measure the quality of care. The agency performed about as well on these metrics as entities in other regions providing similar care. By 2015, the agency had accumulated a significant amount of funds from unspent Medicaid dollars. The board of this public agency chose to pay $131 million in bonuses, more than a quarter of the annual Medicaid funds entrusted to this agency. The bonuses were paid mostly to those who gave up a few weeks' worth of salary to establish the agency back in 1996. Legislators were appalled that unspent Medicaid funds held by this agency went to pay such exorbitant bonuses. They regretted giving the agency such independence. A bill to require more transparency, accountability, and especially more protection of public funds was proposed and earned widespread bipartisan support. Now, retell this story, keeping all the external details the same: the quality of care given to patients, the Medicaid funds involved, the net compensation to the physicians and businesses involved are all the same, but replace gave up with invested, bonuses with return on investment, and public agency with private company. Now you have the essentials of the true Trillium story. I'm surprised that I might also have to delete the prefix "by" from bipartisan to keep it true. To keep it clear, if the payout had merely been an incredibly generous 10% annual return, nobody would have noticed. But at over 10 times that amount, it is disheartening that other CCOs have not helped propose protective legislation. I'm worried as to why.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee, my name is Courtney Johnston. Just quickly, I want to state, never tell John Eames what joke you're going to make in committee, because he'll steal it. But I'm here today on behalf of Coalition for a Healthy Oregon. We're an organization representing 8 of the 16 CCOs and affiliated organizations that serve nearly half of the Oregon Health Plan members in the state. First, I really want to thank the bill's proponents for the new language around CCO transparency. We've always supported board transparency and community accountability, and think this kind of compromise actually goes a long way to improve transparency and in a really meaningful way. So we're very pleased with that addition. Having said that, we are still opposed to this bill and continue to have concerns with the wording in various sections of the bill. While we did kind of help introduce the Dash 10s initially, they didn't come back from Ledge Council in the form that we'd really hoped, so we still have some wording concerns in the current version of the Dash 24s, including the unnecessary, we feel, tax status changes required in the amendment. I'm not going to rehash the discussion from last week, but I just want to touch on a few things that were mentioned today. Outcomes across tax status are no different, and in fact, on the 10 performance measures, which, by the way, is just a sample of the metrics we have, For-profit CCOs have had better outcomes on 6 of the 10 and the same outcomes on 3 of the 10, according to the most recent report. And as I mentioned last week, Representative Barreto, to your point, for-profit CCOs actually retained less dollars in 2015 than the nonprofit CCOs, meaning they spent that money in the community. The Dash 24 amendments require every single one of my COHO members to change their tax status in order to receive a contract in the next time. That we don't believe that's at a benefit to anyone, especially the state of Oregon and the Medicaid members that we serve. COHO's CCOs are committed to investing in social determinants of health, expanding access to care, and reducing health disparities. And we didn't think that the pieces of this bill really help further that effort. But we will continue to offer solutions that we think will improve transformation efforts as we have throughout this entire process. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Williamson, Vice Chairs McLean and Rayfield. My name is Art Suhorzewski, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Family Care Health, which is a nonprofit CCO in Portland. We serve about 120,000 members, and we have about 4,000 providers, behavioral, dental, and physical health care. Thank you for the opportunity to make a brief statement on this bill and the Dash 824 amendments. For the record, we have had a very strong and constructive working relationship with Speaker Kotek and Chair Greenlich on language to improve and strengthen this bill. And we believe that the amendments proposed by the Speaker are certainly a huge improvement over the bill as introduced. There's one piece of the bill that we do believe could be strengthened, but that's a difference in, I guess, implementation, not in intent. And we do believe that the bill should pass the Rules Committee and move to the House floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Sorry. Representative Back.
I'm hoping one of you might be able to answer the question I had previously asked.
Can you repeat the question?
Sorry. I'll try. I'm just curious if you believe that you're at capacity with the folks that you're treating now. Is there a future need for more CCOs? And if so, would this legislation requiring nonprofit CCOs only hinder the growth of CCOs if needed?
I can, Representative Hack, thank you for the question, Chair Williamson. I can only really speak to Family Care Health's experience. Right now, the enrollment process and the fee-for-service at OHA is growing. And so that means we have less revenue. We believe that we have the capacity to actually absorb the members that are on fee-for-service. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
And Chair Williams and Representative Hack, I don't believe that we're at capacity. I think there's certainly room to grow. When you have more enrollees, your rates change, and we can expand access and expand service areas. At least to that point of the question. And I don't know if that helps either, but I'm trying to get to.
Barreto.
Madam Chair. Courtney? Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did you, the comment that you made about how much they spent or how much it cost? Well, could you repeat that?
Yeah, so Chairwoman Representative Barreto. Running the sort of publicly available audited financials from 2015, and I can get through the exact dates, but on aggregate, the for-profit CCOs were retaining less money than on aggregate the nonprofit CCOs. So the money at the end of the year that's in reserves or left over in whatever situation.
The leftover. So what they retain, may I follow up? So the retention, the amount that was retained was greater in the nonprofits, is that what you're saying? Okay, thank you.
Questions? All right, thank you very much. And Jeremiah Rigsby, the final person I have.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Jeremiah Rigsby. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Regulatory Affairs for CARE Oregon. A lot of you know this, but CARE Oregon owns two CCOs in different parts of the state, Jackson County down south, Columbia Pacific up in the northwest portion of the state. We also have over 100,000 people that we have the physical health risk for and health share in the metro area. And I think the thing that we have learned more than anything throughout these last 5 years is that the barriers and challenges and successes that we have accomplished in CCOs change based on the CCO that you're in and the region that you're in. It's really hard with state policy to accomplish the kind of change you want to see in healthcare transformation, sort of a one-size-fits-all thing. My CCOs are in support of this bill because of the flexibility we've gotten to do things like alternative payment methodologies that make sense in our communities, not one alternative payment methodology threshold or not one alternative payment methodology target might make sense in the rural portions of the state versus the metro. We really think that we're doing a lot of good work within alternative payment methodologies, and we look forward to improving that work based on the provisions in the Dash A24 amendment. We're also very supportive of the work that has been done to figure out what portion of the money made through the Oregon Health Plan goes into back into the community. I think we're all wanting money to go back into the community to address the needs that are there. That's what CCOs were established to do. So we're in support of that as well. I know we're strapped on time, so I'll just stop.
Questions? Representative Kenemer.
I think mine's a comment rather than a question. I find myself reflecting back to 2009 and House Bill 2009. I served on that committee. And if I remember right, I was the only Republican who supported that bill out of committee. I remember felt a little bit better when Bob Jensen joined me on the floor in support on the initial vote on 2009. Then I remember it went to the Senate, and they made some changes to it, and it came back, and it became a bipartisan bill. And I just want to reflect that I think that has been a very good thing across the years. I'm concerned about where we seem to be heading.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2122A.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, we have received a minimal fiscal impact on the A24s.
Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 24 amendments to House Bill 2122A.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the Dash A 24 amendments into House Bill 2122A. Is there any discussion? Representative Barreto.
Can we have a short recess?
Yes. We are back on. We have a motion for the A24 amendments. We're in discussion. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be a no on the amendment and a no on the bill.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Aye.
No.
Yes.
Yes. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2122A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 2122A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I find this very disconcerting that here we are admitting that there's no difference in care between a for-profit and a nonprofit. Representations made to House Bill 3650 back in 2011. With regards to what would be a CCO as part of transformation have turned out to not be accurate. So that's very troubling to me. There seems to be implied that somehow medical care provided by a for-profit is somehow morally inferior to medical care provided by a for-profit. That somehow, quote, competing with a profit motive, end quote, means that the doctors, the nurses all the folks who provide care have somehow reduced the level of focus on their patients. I find that incredibly troubling. The public perception as being a basis that there would have to be nonprofits going forward with our CCOs, I think, is a red herring. In the end, this is a clash of philosophy. The Speaker of the House and Representative Greenlick are two people that I respect, but I disagree with them sternly. For-profit companies are not lesser Oregonians, and the employees who work for them are not somehow morally inferior. Doctors, nurses, medical providers of all kind, mental services, and that in the end, we are Oregonian taxpayers that want a service delivered for a price. That is the fundamental notion of the transformation of our healthcare system, is a per capita rate for the delivery of services, triple aim. And what this is, smells of the politics of envy as a result of what happened in Lane County. There's an old saying for lawyers, bad facts make bad law. This is bad law. This will not lead to better results. This opens the door for a debate on whether somehow profit, quote, motives question the ability of people to deliver services in the state. And I just think that door is a Pandora's box. I feel very strong about this, have always felt strong about this, supported healthcare transformation, voted for House Bill 3650, and quite surprised that here we are, such a 6 years later. But so I'm going to be a no. I'm serving notice of a minority report at this point. I didn't ask the speaker any questions the second time because it became clear to me that the reasons her and I disagree on this bill come down to whether we see the delivery of medical care by nonprofits as either superior or not. I just fundamentally disagree as a notion. In the end, this will stifle innovation, we will see a one-day return to whoever can provide the best care at our set prices. But for now, it looks like the House of Representatives is going to go down a path, again, that's going to open up a door and is going to lead to further consequences of this sort of philosophy that looks morally as if the for-profit companies are morally inferior. And I'm just surprised we're doing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to, before I make my remarks, I want to say that I have tremendous respect for the intellect and the passion and advocacy of the representative from District 55. And I don't want this to be construed as some jab at his advocacy or his concerns about this bill. But I would ask people to read it. I feel like the Speaker and the Chair of the Healthcare Committee have tried very hard to thread the needle, because it's hard to solve. I guess, you know, it would be, let's try it this way. People might feel better about the bill if there was some catastrophe or some problem with the care delivery that the CCO model has engendered. Because honestly, the easy thing to do would be to say, let's not do it. Because frankly, it's working. The rest of the country is watching what we're doing with with Medicaid dollars, and trying to figure out how they can mimic it for their part of the world, all right? Because we are doing good things, bending the cost curve, delivering care in a better way. I mean, we have people trying to say that maybe PEB and OEB should be merged into it, and government employees should be given care through this model. So I think it's hard, you know, when you're trying to anticipate a problem to pass a bill like this. We know that the CCOs are evolutionary, and I think part of our challenge has been is that, yes, there was a 30-30 split, you know, session in 2011 when these things were stood up. We also know that in the early 90s, when the Oregon Health Plan was really getting going, it was only, in some places, for-profit entities that were willing to sort of take on the work and the patients. And that this is all sort of a legacy of history that's moved and got us to this place and get us to this next evolution. But I do think I am moved by the fact that this is a lot of taxpayer money, both the state of Oregon and federal tax money, and it deserves a little bit more scrutiny, look at, monitoring, pick an adjective that you like, and I feel like we have tried very hard to thread the needle, and I do think that the situation with what happened with Trillium in Lane County is something that gives some of us pause. And, you know, I don't know that the care that's being delivered in Lane County by the company that took over Trillium is bad care. I don't want to say that at all. I have no basis in which to judge that. But I do think it makes some of us nervous that a company that could come in from another place and make money, which is perfectly fine, on our resources, and then potentially take those profits and leave our state and leave and take reserves and profit they have made that is supposed to be used and invested for the care of Oregonians in that place where that CCO is operating. And I feel like we have tried hard to thread the needle on that as well with regard to the reserves and how we ask how they be spent. And so I will be a yes on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being from Lane County, I have talked to a lot of people in my area, including a few doctors that were part of a CCO down there as well. And overwhelmingly, the response I've heard is that they all think it would be a good idea for CCOs to be nonprofit. For me, it's just relatively simple listening to those folks. Just it provides more assurance for myself and many of my constituents that the public dollars are going to be used, you know, to provide public services. And just fundamentally looking at a for-profit model versus a nonprofit model, that just provides some more assurance and comfort for those, whether, and I'm not saying the care is any better or worse. I just know that many people think that those reserves, those surpluses, you know, should be used to the greatest extent possible for providing the services to people to provide health care. And so I'm going to be a yes based on that. Thank you.
Comments? Sam, can you call the roll?
Representative
Brandon?
No.
Representative Peck?
No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Kettimer?
No.
Representative Mills?
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain?
No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair Williamson?
Yes. Motion carries. Representative Greenlick will be the carrier. I close the work session on House Bill 2122A.
Just to recap today, Madam Chair, we have carried over House Bill 2813, 3203, 3241, and 2893 until Tuesday.
All right. Thank you all. We're adjourned.
Until Tuesday.
All right. Thank you all. We're adjourned.